1 Kings chapter 21, we started our study of this chapter last Sunday morning as we're in the, well, nearing the end of our study of the book of 1 Kings. We are far from finished with our study of the kings of Israel and Judah, which we're in the midst of now. Overall, we some time back started our study from the books of 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles, and having gone through the reigns of Saul and David and Solomon, and then the division of the kingdom occurred after that, we have been following along in parallel with the material that covers these subjects from 1st and 2nd Kings and, well, now the book of 2nd Chronicles. So 2nd Chronicles and 1st Kings have some overlap, particularly when they're talking about or covering the reigns of the kings of Judah, which is the main focus of the book of 2 Chronicles. But right now, as we're studying the reign of King Ahab over Israel, that's the main focus of the books of 1 and 2 Kings, those kings of the northern kingdom that reigned over the 10 tribes of Israel. Judah, along with Benjamin, were ruled over by David's descendants over the kingdom of Judah, as it was known. The other kingdom is referred to as Israel because it is composed or comprised of the of 10 of the tribes of Israel. Ahab is the current king of the northern kingdom. They were all wicked, starting with their first one, Jeroboam the son of Nebat. But they reached what was described at the end of the latter part of 1 Kings chapter 16 of the worst of the kings. That was Omri, who happened to be Ahab's father, compared to all the ones that had been before him. Well, then Ahab, his son, became the worst after him. So we have two, a father and a son, two successive generations that ruled over Israel that were described as being the worst kings that had been in Israel. So Ahab is ruling at a time when spiritually things have reached the lowest point that they have in Israel since they've had these kings. We all know about Ahab and his wicked wife Jezebel. So that's what we've been studying about. And Elijah the prophet we've also been studying about, because he's the chief prophet that God has been using during these years of Ahab's reign to not only to rebuke the wickedness of Ahab and Jezebel and the children of Israel, and we're going to see more of that here in chapter 21, Lord willing, but also to be used by God to try to build faith in these people of Israel that had been led astray for so long. There were other prophets around that we've already seen, particularly in the previous chapter, that God was also using during these years in Israel, but Elijah has been the main one. But as we started our study of chapter 21 now, there's this Naboth, who was a Jezreelite, who had a vineyard, and his vineyard, his land, was adjacent to, right next to Ahab's land at his palace. So he is, he has a very bad geographical location for his property, because the king of Israel, this wicked king of Israel, is going to covet that land, and he's going to have it, and it's going to cost Naboth his life. So we started our look at this chapter last week with verses 1 through 3, which we want to read again now, because we have still some matters to complete our study of in this chapter. But 1 Kings chapter 21, verses 1 through 3 says, "And it came to pass after these things that Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard, which was in Jezreel, hard by the palace of Ahab king of Samaria. And Ahab spake unto Naboth, saying, Give me thy vineyard, that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it is near unto my house, and I will give thee for it a better vineyard than it. Or if it seem good to thee, I will give thee the worth of it in money. And Nadab said to Ahab, The Lord forbid it me, that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee. Now, we might stop at verse 2 and consider, well, this was, Ahab was being fair here to offer him some better land in exchange, or to give him a fair price and money for him to sell it to him. And, well, we might even ask the question on that, how trustworthy would Ahab be in that? But this is not what the issue is for Naboth, whether he's going to trust this wicked king to be fair in a deal to try to get that land. What is Naboth's reason for refusing to do that? Is he just being stubborn? Is he just being difficult? Is he being obnoxious or something like that? No, he's not. None of those things. Verse 3, he gives the reason. He says, the Lord, and uses that name Yahweh, Jehovah. So does Naboth appear to be a man, one of these ones in Israel? The Lord said he still had 7,000 that were in Israel that had not bowed their knee to Baal. Does it seem that this Naboth is one of those 7,000? Well, we might say, well, how could he possibly be when he's the next door neighbor of Ahab himself? Well, what did we learn about Obadiah, Ahab's own governor? He was a worshiper of God. So there was one in Ahab's own palace right next to Ahab. Well, now it's very obvious he's got one that lives next door to him too. So Naboth is one that is not speaking about Baal here. He boldly states Jehovah is the one that he's following, and he's the one whose commandments he's concerned with. So Naboth, he fears the Lord, and he's trying to keep his commandments. And he says that God is the reason that he's not letting him have that land. What is the reason that he gives? The Lord forbid it me that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee. Now, had God done that? Had God forbidden Naboth to let his inheritance go to King Ahab? Well, yes, in fact, he had. As he had given a commandment to all Israel concerning their inheritance. Well, there were 12 tribes in Israel that were given land to inherit. And we're having to summarize because if we were to go through and actually read all of that history, we would fail in our time this morning to be able to do that in the detail that we would like to. But that is a good opportunity or task for us in our own study, perhaps even this afternoon, to go back and look at some of that in some more detail. But God had promised Abraham to give him that land of Canaan to his descendants through Isaac and Jacob. And then Jacob had 12 sons who were the fathers. Isaac had Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons who became the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel. And it was their descendants who were given the land in Israel as their inheritance, as God had promised. Now, those 12 tribes of Israel, did that mean each of those 12 sons of Jacob, that their descendants each got a given territory? Almost, but not quite. There were 12 tribes that received land inheritance in Israel, but were those 12 exactly the 12 sons of Jacob? All but one. Levi was one of the sons of Jacob, but were the Levites given a land inheritance in Israel? They were not. The Lord was their inheritance. In that sense, also Simeon was not given a separate contiguous piece of land as their inheritance. They were given cities within the inheritance of Judah. Going back to the book of Genesis, when Dinah, their sister, one of the daughters of Jacob, was evil entreated by Shechem, what did Levi and Simeon do to Shechem, to that town? Well, they destroyed it. Slaughtered the males there of Shechem in their anger. And there was a curse placed upon them from the Lord because of that anger, and that was that they would not be given Levi and Simeon would be given cities. They would not be given a land inheritance. Now, in the case of Levi, there was something good. That wasn't the end of the story for him. He was one who feared the Lord. Now, his hatred of evil, he carried to an excess into an hatred of the people and took a vengeance and anger that he should not have in that case with Shechem. But within his heart, there was much good. Levi did fear the Lord, and God made a covenant with him because he hated evil, and he loved righteousness, which is the essence of the fear of the Lord. And he turned many away from iniquity in his life. So that one matter was not all there was of the life of Levi by any means. It was a life lived by a righteous man, such that God made a covenant with him that it was going to be his descendants that would be the priests in Israel, because that quality that was in Levi, their father, is exactly the quality, the basic quality that needed to be present in his descendants, those who would be priests. God needed a body of individuals that would be responsible for guiding the nation spiritually, that would hate evil, love righteousness, that would teach God's law to the people and turn people from iniquity to righteousness. That's why he made that covenant with Levi. And all of that is reviewed or covered in Malachi chapter 2 in some detail if you want to look at that part. But so Levi later was given not a land inheritance. Again, that was partially due to what happened regarding Shechem. But God also turned that into something that was good because they were the descendants of Levi were the priests in Israel. Well, how would that serve the nation if all the priests were concentrated just in one area? That would not have fulfilled that purpose for them. They needed to be among all the tribes of Israel. So God did keep that promise that he had made that was actually, in one sense, a curse because of what happened at Shechem by giving Levi cities in Israel. But it turned into a blessing for them and for all Israel that they were among all the tribes so that the priests could be present, that they would be among all of them and the Levites, the rest of the Levites who would support them, the priests and their work. So the Levites were given cities among the tribes. Simeon was given cities among Judah. All the rest of the tribes were given an actual territory of land with borders, contiguous territory that they occupied. Now, to add up to 12, then if you take Levi out of the picture, if you're going to keep 12, that means somebody's got to get two, right? Take away one, you got to add another to keep the numbers the same, to add up to 12. And that was for the household of Joseph. So Joseph was given a double portion of the inheritance, the land inheritance, which normally that would go to which one of the sons, well, of any man, but in this case would have gone to the which son of Jacob. Well, it'd be the firstborn, who happened to be Reuben. But Reuben committed immorality, and so he was given that curse that the birthright was taken away, that included both the rulership among his brethren as well as the double portion of a land inheritance. And that was then divided. Who did God give the rulership in Israel to? Who became the tribe of the rulers? Who became the royal tribe? And it was Judah, which was God's will, that because he was going to bring his son through that tribe. So that fulfilled that. So God was doing a lot of different things through all of this. That's why we're just mentioning these now, and that's why it takes up. This involves a lot of different chapters in the Bible and different books, but God brought all of this in together for many different reasons. But as far as the land inheritance, the double portion was given to the house of Joseph, so you had a separate inheritance for Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. So that's how that all worked out. But so there were 12 tribes that were given inheritance. Joseph got two separately for his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. All right. So of those tribes then that in the book of Joshua after they conquered the land, and that book gives the details of which territory they occupied and the borders of. They were very precise borders. Now, to keep the peace among God's people, if they had, if there was a, if, and we're going to see the issue. In fact, you can already start turning to Numbers chapter 27. If you had in a situation where land was changing hands from one tribe to another, would that create the opportunity for some tribes to gradually be losing territory, others to be gaining? Could that be a source of strife and division among God's people? And it's not difficult at all to foresee that being the case. And that would be contrary to God's desires. He wanted there to be his people to be unified, and for them, he didn't want his people to be end up in constant fights and battles over land and possessions. So God created it by His law when He established those borders of their territory, that would remain. The inheritances of those families and those tribes would remain within them. And where this becomes an issue at first is in Numbers chapter 27, a little more background. Well, 12 tribes got land inheritance. Again, Simeon with cities in Judah for the reasons we mentioned. There were 2.5 tribes, the tribe of Reuben, Gad, and then half of Manasseh, that desired to have the land that was on the east side of Jordan that they conquered from Sihon and Og over there, that included Bashan and Gilead. Those were land plains and good land for cattle and animals, grazing animals, which is what those tribes had, and so they wanted their inheritance there. That was granted them with the condition that as their brethren had helped them to conquer their land, that they would have to go over with their brethren across the Jordan River and help them in conquering the rest of the land. And only after all of it was conquered, all of it would be divided up and given to all the tribes, and then they could have their land there. So that was the condition that God gave. Now we have an issue that comes up here in Numbers chapter 27, where one of the families from Gilead, who was of half the tribe of Manasseh that was going to receive their territory on the east side of Jordan, this particular family, this man had daughters and no sons. Well, under the normal convention in that case, if inheritance was only given to sons, then this man would lose his territory, because he would only have daughters. And then, so this issue comes to bear here when the daughters of this man named Zelophehad, requesting, that they be given inheritance, as his sons. To preserve the territory within the family, to keep it stable without it changing over. And God gave commandment concerning this based on this situation. So we'll start in verse 1 of Numbers chapter 27. Then came the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. And these are the names of his daughters, Mahlah, Noah, and Hogla, and Milcah, and Tirzah. And they stood before Moses, and before Eleazar the priest, and before the princes, and all the congregation by the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness, and he was not in the company of them that gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but died in his own sin and had no sons. Why should the name of our father be done away from among his family, because he had no son? Give unto us, therefore, a possession among the brethren of our father." And Moses brought their cause before the Lord. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, "The daughters of Zelophehad speak right. Thou shalt surely give them a possession of an inheritance among their father's brethren, and thou shalt cause the inheritance of their father to pass unto them. And thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel, saying, If a man die and have no son, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass unto his daughter. And if he have no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance unto his brethren. And if he have no brethren, then you shall give his inheritance unto his father's brethren. And if his father have no brethren, then you shall give it his inheritance unto his kinsman that is next to him of his family. And he shall possess it, and it shall be unto the children of Israel a statute of judgment, as the Lord commanded Moses. Now, is there a footnote to that in fine print that says, unless it happens to be next door to a king who wants your land, and then it can go to him? No, that footnote isn't there. There is no fine print to this. God gave that commandment, and it's very clear. The inheritance of each piece of land in Israel was to remain within the families that it originally went to. Would that create stability with in Israel? Would that be a way to prevent there being conflict in those things? Yes, it was. So when Ahab is coming to Naboth here in 1 Kings chapter 21, and by the way, if you just as a note for later study, it's in Numbers chapter 36 when all that was done, and Zelophehad's daughters did receive their inheritance. So that did come to pass exactly like they requested, and like God answered and said what they were saying was right, and he gave that commandment. Well, was Naboth aware of that commandment of God, that the inheritance that he was given of his family needed to stay within his family, and he couldn't just exchange it and get some land somewhere else from Ahab, nor could he just sell it outright? You know, what would happen if somebody, if the wealthy and powerful could just buy up land because they happen to have more money? Would that lead to conflict? Would that lead to problems in Israel? Of course it would. So that was against the will of God. So when Naboth says, "The Lord forbid it me that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee," was he speaking right? He was speaking right. He was concerned with that commandment of God, and he intended to obey that commandment of God. Now that happened to put him at odds with the most powerful man in the nation, who was a very wicked man and was married to a wicked woman. So his adherence to God's commandment, his fear of the Lord that he was going to keep God's commandment, he was going to carry to his death. He was going to be killed for his obedience to God here. Well, is he the first man that paid with his life for his fear of the Lord and keeping his commandments? He wasn't the first, nor was he the last. But it's sad to see that this happened to him by one of his own brethren in Israel, this King Ahab. Sets up what the rest of the events in chapter 21 are about. So Naboth refused Ahab's, my mouth is combining the names Ahab and Naboth. I don't mean Nahab. Naboth is going to disappear, so there's only going to be Ahab after this in short order, but sadly for him. But after he's refused Ahab his request for the land, Ahab is not going to be happy with being rejected. And in fact, chapter 20 closed with the words of chapter 20, verse 43, after a prophecy was spoken against Ahab because he had spared Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, in that chapter in battle when God delivered it into his hands and had appointed him for destruction, but Ahab spared him. God sent a prophet that said that he was going to give his life, would be required life, his life for the life of Ben-Hadad and his people for Ben-Hadad's people, the Syrians. And we mentioned then, and in fact, it's going to come about in the next chapter that's going to be fulfilled. Ahab is going to fall in battle against the Syrians in Ramoth, in Gilead, in this region of land on the east side of Jordan where those tribes, the 2.5 tribes, were given their inheritance that we were going back to the book of Numbers about. Well, it's that land over there. The Syrians encroached upon Gilead, and of course that was from God that he was sending their enemies to punish Israel, and so Ahab was trying to go force that land back into his possession. Well, how was he going to do that when God is the one that had taken it away? the only solution to his problem was to fix what caused God to take it away in the first place, and that was his wickedness. But instead of doing that, he tried to force the land back into his hands in battle, and he fell, like God told. But his chariot was going to be brought back and washed out in Jezreel, in the very plot of ground that is Naboth's land, where his blood is going to be shed. And so God was, and Elijah is going to prophesy about that here. So a lot of prophecies are going to be filled against Ahab involving all of this. But the last verse of 1 Kings 20, that is verse 43, when that prophecy was spoken against him in that chapter after he spared Ben-Hadad, it says that he went to his house heavy and displeased. Well, verse 4, now in 1 Kings 21, after being rejected by Naboth, Ahab came into his house heavy and displeased. So he's being heavy and displeased a lot these days. But why? Well, it's because he's doing evil. I mean, what he did in chapter 20 and sparing one that God delivered into his hand for destruction, that was an evil thing. Now to covet Naboth's land and try to take possession of it, even by what in his mind he might consider a fair offer, it was still against God's commandment. This was evil. And so he's sore and displeased because he's not getting what he wants. So what does he do when he's sore and displeased? It says, he was heavy and displeased because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him, for he had said, I will not give thee the inheritance of my fathers. And he laid him down upon his bed and turned away his face and would eat no bread. Now, what is the word that describes what he's doing here? He's pouting. And so here he is lying down on his bed. Doesn't say whether or not he's sucking his thumb, but he's not eating and he's turned his face to the wall. And so he's having a big pout session now because he didn't get what he wanted. And so in verse 5, but Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said unto him, why is thy spirit so sad that thou eatest no bread? And he said unto her, because, and it's hard to read this without putting the whiny tone to it that you know he had. But he says, because I spake unto Naboth the Jezreelite and said unto him, give me thy vineyard for money, or else if it please thee, I will give thee another vineyard for it. And he answered, I will not give thee my vineyard. So he's pouting and he's mad because Naboth wouldn't let him have what he wanted. So Jezebel, his wife, in verse 7, said to him, dost thou now govern the kingdom of Israel? I mean, who are you? You're the king. So since you're the king, if you want something, you get it. I mean, that's her point here. Dost thou now govern the kingdom of Israel? Arise and eat bread and let thine heart be merry. I will give thee the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite. Leave this to me. I will take care of this. You're the king. You want this vineyard? You're going to have this vineyard. I'll take care of it. All right, and she is. But does Ahab, does he know his wife? Is Ahab going to be the one here that's going to actually bear false witness against Naboth? Is he going to be the one that's going to have him stoned and killed based on knowingly false testimony, and then do all of these things that are going to lead to his land becoming available that he can just take it? Is Ahab personally going to take those actions? His wife is going to do it. But when Jezebel says, let your heart be merry, I will give thee the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, is there any way that's going to happen without wickedness occurring? So in spite of the fact that Ahab, with his own hands, isn't going to do the things that Jezebel is, and so we can ask the question, is Jezebel willing to do more wickedness personally than Ahab demonstrates? And the answer is yes. I mean, she's worse than he is in many, many ways. But he's going along with it. He's letting her do these things. And this is not the first time. I mean, he set up the temple for Baal in Samaria. There were 450 prophets of Baal that ate at Jezebel's table. These were works of Jezebel. But did Ahab go along with it? Or did he try to stop it? Did he oppose her? Not in any way. And he knows her wicked heart. And when she says, I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, She's going to do something very evil. He knows it, and he's not going to do anything to stop that. So is he complicit in this? Is he himself guilty of Naboth's blood and all of these evil deeds that his wife does because he knows she's going to do it? She's told him she's going to do it. So he's not going to be innocent of this. God is going to hold him responsible. And he's going to bring his punishment upon him for his involvement in this. But also Jezebel too. So they're both going to be held guilty by God because they both are guilty before God. But it's a reminder that if evil is going on, and we have the authority, the ability, the position, the opportunity, all of those things to stand up against or to stop evil, and we don't, are we going to be held accountable by God for evil that is done? Now, what somebody else does that we have no control over, that's not under our authority, are we going to be held responsible for what other people do then? No. But when it is, when it's in our domain, if we have authority in that area and we don't do anything, then how's God going to respond to us then? Well, like he did with Ahab, because he is, like Jezebel says, do you now govern the kingdom of Israel? The answer is yes. He has authority over Israel. Well, does he have authority in his house as king and as, well, he, I mean, by God he does. Now, is he exercising it properly? Of course not. But is God going to hold him accountable for not restraining his wife when she's going to do this evil? He's responsible. He's responsible for what's done in his family and his kingdom. But he's not going to stop that. We do have a reminder of this principle in the New Testament. We have many, but just to illustrate the point in the book of Revelation in chapter 2, in these part of these letters to the seven churches in Asia that the Lord Jesus Christ wrote to these congregations, five of the seven were guilty of evil that he said literally, repent or else. Well, one of those, the church at Thyatira, that he writes to in Revelation chapter 2, he had a few things against them, and the name Jezebel is going to come up here. In verse 20 of Revelation 2, he says, notwithstanding, I have a few things against thee, because thou sufferest, thou allow that woman Jezebel, which calleth herself a prophetess, to teach and to seduce my servants to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed unto idols. Well, now there was obviously someone wicked there that was involved in leading these Christians, these members of the church at Thyatira in Asia Minor in this time, into this evil. But for her to be doing those actions, and it's not by accident that he refers to her by the name Jezebel, that woman Jezebel. So they have their own Jezebel in the church here. But as the Jezebel, the namesake that's back here that we're studying about now in the book of 1 Kings, as she was doing much wickedness among God's people, and Ahab was responsible and would not restrain her, but in fact allowed her to do her evil. That same point is being brought up here with the church at Thyatira. I mean, here was this one that he refers to as that woman Jezebel that was doing these evil things, but the Lord is writing to the church. He says, I have a few things against you. He doesn't say against her. Well, he obviously does, but what does he have against the church there? Because thou sufferest. What does that word mean? Allow. The church was allowing this, their Jezebel, to do these things, just like Ahab allowed his Jezebel to do her things. So he's making that direct comparison there. So the principle we're seeing right here in 1 Kings 21, the Lord applies to his church, as we're reading it there in Revelation chapter 2. We're responsible for what goes on in the body of Christ here at North Columbia and whatever congregation the Lord has given authority to the leaders of the congregation for what goes on there. And if evil is taught or practiced in a church, and the church is not doing anything about it, allowing it to happen, the Lord's going to hold accountable the church for allowing it to happen. We're responsible for what's taught and practiced here. And so if there's a false doctrine, if there's immorality being practiced, and we're not opposing it, we have been given the authority to do so, and we're allowing it to go on, we're going to be held accountable to God for that. That principle applies to our families, it applies to the church, it applies to any area where we have been given responsibility, authority from God, and we need to use that and exercise that in the right way. And so as far as what our responsibility here, we better make sure that what is true and right is taught and practiced faithfully as far as the congregation here, and that we're not like the church at Thyatira. Well, here in 1 Kings chapter 21, this Ahab is allowing his Jezebel to do this evil, and God's going to hold him accountable too. So we don't want to forget that principle. Well, here it is on display with Ahab as she says she was going to give the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to her husband Ahab. So how's she going to do it? Well, she's going to do it by evil. Well, what particular means is she going to come up with? Well, let's read further. Verse 8. So she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal. Well, how did she get that? How did she get his seal? So, I mean, Ahab is all kinds of involved in this. She's doing the works, but he's going along with it. He's allowing it to happen. She's got his seal, writing letters in his name, using his stamp, official stamp as the king of Israel on it, and sent the letters unto the elders and to the nobles that were in his city dwelling with Naboth. And she wrote in the letters saying, proclaim a fast and set Naboth on high among the people, and set two men, sons of Belial, before him to bear witness against him, saying, thou didst blaspheme God and the king, and then carry him out and stone him that he may die. And the men of his city, even the elders of the noble and the nobles that were the inhabitants in his city, did as Jezebel had sent unto them, and did as it was written in the letters which she had sent unto them. They proclaimed a fast and set Naboth on high among the people. And there came in two men, children of Belial, that sat before him. And the men of Belial witnessed against him, even against Naboth, in the presence of the people, saying, Naboth did blaspheme God and the king. Then they carried him forth out of the city and stoned him with stones that he died. Then they sent to Jezebel, saying, Naboth is stoned and is dead. And it came to pass when Jezebel heard that Naboth was stoned and was dead, that Jezebel said to Ahab, arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give thee for money, for Naboth is not alive but dead. And it came to pass when Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, that Ahab rose up to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. So Naboth was killed, and was killed based on the testimony of false witnesses that were intentionally set up to bear false witness against him, so that by false accusation that he would be unjustifiably killed, so that then his vineyard would be available for Ahab to take for possession. Well, this is wickedness of a very advanced order that we're reading about here. I mean, how many people would be willing to do that? To enlist people to knowingly lie against somebody so that they could be killed wrongly, so that you could then take their possessions away. This is severe evil, and it's breaking many of the commandments. Actually, many of the Ten Commandments are being broken simultaneously through all of this. What are the great commandments? What is the great commandment in the law? Well, Jesus was asked that question in Matthew chapter 22. If we can go there, let's read from Matthew chapter 22, verses 35 through 40. Then one of them, which was a lawyer, asked him a question, tempting him and saying, Master, which is the great commandment in the law? Well, they were trying to set up a trap for him with so that based on whatever answer he would give, they would try to seize hold of those words and then find an issue where they could accuse him of saying something that was wrong. Now, at this point, with what had already happened, and we could go back and read all of this chapter, as well as other encounters they'd had with him, and to see how he answered One could ask, why are they still trying? But they are. And so with that question, Jesus gave the answer in verse 37. Of course, he's giving the right answer. Which is the great commandment in the law? Does he say, well, there isn't. They're all exactly equal in greatness. No. Now, were they all equal in authority that they all had to be obeyed? Yes. In fact, he dealt with that in the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 5. What did Jesus say about those who would break one of the least of these commandments? In fact, with those words, he even at that time recognized there was an order to things. There was a degree. But what did Jesus say about those who would break one of the least of those commandments? Or that would change one jot or tittle? Jesus wouldn't change one jot or tittle. He was going to fulfill all of it. But anyone that would break one of those least commandments or teach men to do so, of course, they were going to suffer punishment from God for doing so. So Jesus had already upheld the necessity of obeying all the commandments of God from greatest to least. But when they ask him what is the great commandment of the law, he's going to give an answer. There is one commandment that was greater than all the commandments, and then there was going to be commandment number two that was going to be greater than all the others. In fact, he's going to say that every other commandment is going to be based upon the first two. So verse 37, Jesus said unto him, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. To love God and then to love the neighbor, and loving the neighbor based on the love for God. Every commandment that God gave, every other commandment, was based on those of loving God and loving their neighbor. All other commandments hung upon those two. Jesus taught that there in Matthew 22. If we turn to Romans chapter 13, and we see this principle also being taught here, and many of the Ten Commandments are, most of them in fact, are being repeated here in Romans chapter 13 in this letter to the church at Rome, which is a letter to Christians, all Christians for all time. And this is yet another passage where we find most of the Ten Commandments being included as part of the New Testament, the law of Christ. So do we keep the Ten Commandments? Well, we keep nine of them, almost all of them verbatim. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain is one we find in principle taught as concerning our words. In fact, the words that Christ teaches about that, we have even more strict commandment as far as our words go even than that in the New Testament. We don't find that commandment verbatim in the New. The rest of them, we really do. The only exception is the commandment to observe the Sabbath. That is not included in the New Testament. And in fact, Colossians chapter 2 explicitly says that not to let anyone judge us on the Sabbath. So all those laws about feast days and the new moons, the Sabbaths, that was not included in the New Testament. So we don't keep the nine of the Ten Commandments because they're in among those Ten Commandments, but because they're included in the law of Christ. That's why we observe them today. But he's giving us the reason why he's included those in Romans chapter 13. It's the same reason they were part of the law in the first place, based on what Jesus said. It's part of loving God and loving your neighbor. So Romans 13 verses 8 through 10 says, owe no man anything but to love one another. For he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. Sound like what Jesus said? Absolutely. Verse 9, for this, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. If there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. So that's expounding on what Jesus said there in that passage that we read in Matthew 22, verses 37 through 40. But there he mentions or repeats many of the Ten Commandments and tells us that this is part of loving our neighbor. And love does not work ill to his neighbor. Well, which of those commandments that he mentions there in verse 9, if we break, are we not working ill to our neighbor? I mean, if somebody commits adultery, they're working ill to their neighbor. I mean, she or he is somebody else's spouse. I mean, that's working ill against that spouse, certainly. And their children. potentially. I mean, it's going to be working ill against a lot of people to commit that sin. Thou shalt not kill. I mean, that's obvious. That's going to work the ultimate ill against whoever is the victim of that one. But how many other people are going to be harmed when someone is murdered? Is it just that person that suffers consequences or suffers, bears evil in their lives because of that murder? How many other lives are affected when somebody is murdered? Many lives are impacted in an ill way for that, but obviously, chiefly the one who's killed. Stealing from another. If you're stealing somebody's goods, you're working ill to them. That shouldn't require any explanation. Bearing false witness, telling lies against them, falsely accusing someone, and coveting what is theirs. That's working ill to one's neighbor. To love is to fulfill the law. Well, what's Ahab doing here? And Jezebel to Naboth. I mean, how many of these commandments are being broken? Well, he's repeating many of the Ten Commandments in Romans 13. In the original giving of the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20, we see a list of these commandments that Ahab and his wife Jezebel broke in their lives. I mean, the first of the Ten Commandments is in verse 3 of Exodus 20, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." Had they broken that one? What about that temple of Baal that was in Samaria? In verse 4, the second of the Ten Commandments, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. Had they broken that one? They had broken that one. Now, as far as the ones that followed from there, taking the name of the Lord in vain, well, they had no regard for God at all. And in a sense, in those letters, we can see that. But, I mean, we know that Ahab and Jezebel had no regard for the Lord at all. It's doubtful they kept the Sabbath as well. Now, how did Ahab honor his father and mother? Well, maybe by his standpoint, he honored his father by exceeding his wickedness, where he had been the most wicked king that Israel ever had. He decided to go further than that. So whatever his father achieved, he went beyond that. That's not exactly honoring in the sense that God intended, is it? But getting down to when we get to verse 13 of Exodus 20, "Thou shalt not kill." What did they do to Naboth? "Thou shalt not commit adultery." "Thou shalt not steal." What do they do to Naboth and his vineyard? Verse 16, "Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor." What do they do to Naboth? Verse 17, "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house," etc. And all of his possessions that are mentioned there in Exodus 20, verse 17. What have they done to Naboth? So where did this really start? It started with the covetousness. Ahab coveted that vineyard. And then after he coveted that vineyard, it led to the bearing of false witness, to the killing of Naboth, to the stealing of his vineyard. So we have four of the Ten Commandments that are plainly broken in this one incident, all starting with the coveting. And so that's what happened. When we read Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 through 19, and again we see that there are particular things that the Lord loves, especially, and there are particular things that the Lord hates above other things. He hates all evil, but Proverbs 6, verse 16 says, "These six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him." All right, how many of these are committed by Ahab and Jezebel here in 1 Kings 21? "A proud look, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren." Just about all of them there. So, I mean, breaking of many of the Ten Commandments, these things that God said he hates, that are an abomination to him, we see virtually the whole list being committed by Ahab and Jezebel against Naboth. Here in 1 Kings chapter 21. It's also a reminder where sin starts. I mean, it starts with the covetousness. And where does covetousness occur? I mean, that's what, of course, it occurs in the heart. That's where the source of all the evil that men do. It's also the source of good. We need good in our heart, so from that good treasure we'll bring forth good things instead of that evil treasure, the evil things that will be come forth from the evil treasure that's in a heart. But covetousness begins with thought as a thought in a heart, a desire, an evil desire for something. In James chapter 1, the Lord traces out this pathway and how sin is committed. James chapter 1, in verse 13, he says, let no man, actually we'll go back to verse 12, because verse 12 is the positive side. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation. So the devil's going to bring temptation before us all, and we need to recognize the temptation where it is, and then with that shield of faith that comes from hearing God's word, then quench that fiery dart, stop it in its tracks, that it goes no further, so that we overcome and endure that temptation. And he says, blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. Verse 13 of James 1, let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. So can we blame and say it's God's fault? We can't. Now what about the famous saying, well, the devil made me do it. Of course, the devil is the one that's trying to entice us to do evil, but that's also an accusation against God if we say that the devil has been given permission to give us a temptation above what we're able to bear. And that's false. So whose fault is it if we commit sin? It's our fault if we do that. Verse 14 says, but every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. Every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust, his own desire. Was Ahab tempted by beginning with being drawn away of his own desire and being enticed, coveting Naboth's vineyard? Did that desire conceive? And then when it was conceived, did it bring forth, did it give birth to sin, which leads to death? Well, of course, we know it led to Naboth's death. He's talking about spiritual death, separation from God that comes from our own sins. But sadly, of course, his sin, when it was born, that began with that conception, his evil desires, when it conceived and it brought forth from its spiritual womb that sin. Look at what was brought forth with that bearing false witness and the killing and the stealing. But that all started with the coveting in his heart. That's the reason why Jesus in Matthew chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, when he's attacking sin and teaching us how to not fall prey to it, just exactly along the lines of the principles we just saw there in James 1, when we listen to Jesus' words, where do we have to fight the battle? We have to fight the battle beginning there in our own hearts and minds. And in Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 and 22, he says, you've heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. I mean, how many murders just come about without first there being evil thoughts that involve, well, it can be many different motives, whether it's covetousness or envy, anger, all those kinds of things. But if the battle is fought, first of all, with whatever thought comes up that the devil puts there to try to tempt us, and if that is conquered right there so it does not conceive, then it's not going to bring forth the sin. Similarly, just a few verses down, 27 and 28, Jesus said, you've heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery, but I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. The battle has to be first fought there. And if that's conquered, if we are not thinking about and looking at things that we should not, and we don't let those thoughts then conceive so that they bring forth sin, well, then that's how we win the battle. That's how Jesus did. It is written, and that's what he said, and that's how he quenched every fiery dart of the wicked one, and that's how he did not commit any sin against God. Well, we need to follow his teachings, but we see the opposite pathway here in 1 Kings 21 when that covetousness was allowed to conceive, and then it brought forth all of these sins against Naboth, resulting in bearing false witness, killing, and then stealing. Well, after this is all over, then God's going to send Elijah, beginning there in verse 17, when God's word comes to Elijah, and he's going to prophesy against Ahab and Jezebel for these sins. We are out of time now, so Lord willing, next week we will continue our study from that point in 1 Kings chapter 21. We do encourage anyone that's able to participate in whatever ways you can, like this morning, to do so again, Lord willing, next Lord's Day.